This is Kelly Swales. I'm the web editor of Lab Medicine Magazine. Welcome to our podcast series. Talking with us today is Dennis Ernst. He's the executive director at the Center for Phlebotomy Education in Indiana, and he's going to talk with us for a little bit today about quality assurance issues in phlebotomy.
Yeah, thank you, Kelly, and welcome, everyone. It's a pleasure to be connected with you today. For those of you who are unaware of the Center for Phlebotomy Education, my background is as an MT ASEP, and I've been on the bench forever. In 1998, though, I left the bench to start an education company that would focus strictly on the pre-analytical phase of laboratory testing, and that brings us up to date. So we are immersed in the subject, do speak internationally. Many of you may receive our newsletters and so forth. So what I want to talk today about is a lot of what is the most critical aspects of the laboratory testing being the pre-analytical phase, and how do we assure specimen quality? How do we assure personnel standards? How do we make sure that our patients are being treated according to accurate test results? And several authors refer to this as the dark side of the clinical laboratory, and I think to a large extent that's pretty fair. The dark side, as I think of it, being that part of the laboratory testing process that doesn't have enough light shining on it, especially when we're talking about the pre-analytical phase. And I say this can be considered the dark side because many of the mistakes that occur throughout the laboratory process occur in this pre-analytical phase. In fact, by some studies, up to 93% of all of the errors that are committed in the entire laboratory process occur before the sample is even tested. So this pre-analytical area, also becoming more well-known as the pre-examination phase, is where we need to have more light shining because many of these errors that occur cannot be detected. They can't be fixed by those who test the sample. For example, somebody receives a sample for testing. Let's say a CBC comes in, and it could be grossly hemolyzed because of any number of pre-analytical variables and how the sample was collected or how the sample was transported. And as a result, that CBC is going to have a falsely low red count, falsely low hematocrit, just because of how the sample was collected and because it was hemolyzed. See, because we never see that red-tinged serum or the red-tinged plasma like we do in the chemistry department that tells us the sample is hemolyzed and allows us to reject it, see, because we're testing whole blood. So we can't shine a light on a sample with an error like that. It has to be prevented up front. Other examples would be, let's take it to the chemistry department. If the sample was drawn in an incorrect order of draw, and let's say the EDTA was filled before the serum tube that's going to ultimately be tested for potassium, and that EDTA carries over into the serum tube, there's enough potassium in that additive that can carry over to really spike that potassium level to no small degree, falsely elevating the patient's reported potassium result. And so here we go. The patient's going to be diagnosed, medicated, managed, treated, all according to inaccurate potassium results. And it can be catastrophic. So I think the dark side of phlebotomy has to be this pre-analytical phase in which errors cannot be detected. Oh, sure, some can. But by and large, many pre-analytical errors are invisible. You never know they occurred, and you never know how they're affecting the sample. That's why we have to shine some light on this aspect of laboratory testing. And I want to call your attention to an article recently published in Lab Medicine. This is the summer of 2012 issue. Very interesting study conducted in Brazil. What they did is they invited 1,000 laboratory managers to participate in an observational study that required them to observe their blood collection personnel on the frequency in which certain venipuncture practices were performed. And the results are pretty astounding. what they found is that with these phlebotomists, 83% of them requested their patients to pump their fist. Now, you and I both know pumping the fist to distend the veins and make them easy to find is great if you're having difficult finding the veins, but they're not so great when it comes to managing the patient, because fist pumping, that act alone can elevate the potassium level that the physician acts upon by 25-30%. And so here we go again. We could have a perfectly normal potassium result, but because of fist pumping, it's elevated, and the patient gets treated or managed, or maybe it can't go to surgery because the potassium is too high to make it a safe procedure, all unnecessarily, of course. And the other side of the coin here is, what if the potassium is falsely low and the patient should not go to surgery, or the patient needs medication or treatment because of a falsely low potassium, but because the person who drew the sample put the EDTA tube out of order in the order of draw and filled it first, the tube that was tested for potassium now suddenly is reflecting a normal value, which is falsely representing the patient. So you see, you can't look at the sample. The testing personnel is not going to look at that sample and say, oh, can't do this, he pumped his fish, can't you see this, how it looks? You just can't detect it. It has to be proactively prevented. We have to shine light on these errors that cannot be detected in the analytical phase. Another thing they found out is that 80% of the tubes were filled in the wrong order. Okay, so that underscores what we just mentioned. And they also found that 83% failed to properly mix the tubes. And failure to mix the tubes results, of course, in clot formation, which can really mess up the instrumentation, if it even, and should it actually go so far as to get a test result, well, then it could be affected because of microclots that nobody knows about. So here we have three major pre-analytical errors that occurred in these 10 hospitals in which these specimen collection personnel were evaluated, and they didn't know they were being evaluated, so it's pretty much a blind study here. And so I think if we look further in the article, we can see that the conclusion the authors came to was that better training for phlebotomists with major emphasis placed on sources of errors, as discussed in this article, would improve the overall quality of clinical laboratory testing. Now, I think that's isn't that an obvious kind of thing? We all know that. Better training is going to lead to more accurate test results and more precise clinical laboratory testing. But how many of us are actually taking steps to implement what we know, to provide that better training, to monitor our staff and to assess their performance? You know what? Here's the interesting thing with this study that I find very telling. They sent this survey to about 1,000 laboratories, the researchers did. Only 10 of them agreed to participate in this study out of 1,000, only 10. And the reason most of those who chose not to participate that they gave for opting out is, and this is a quote from the article, should the external expert auditor find some nonconformity in my procedure, either my job or my relationship with the employer might be jeopardized. So here we have, it really underscores the problem we have. And look, I don't believe for 1 minute this is unique to Brazil. What we have here are people who fear for their job. Should a study or a survey show that their subordinates are performing below the standards? That's got to change. When people are afraid to shine a light in this dark side of phlebotomy because they fear reprisals, they fear their own job security, there's a culture there that needs immediate attention and immediate change, because people should not be afraid of their own jobs when they shine a light on a deficiency. So I think this all falls under the category of, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, right? And how do we become part of the solution? Well, because all of these errors, most of these errors are not detectable after they're committed, the only way we can prevent things like this happening, the incorrect order of draw, prolonged tourniquet constriction on the arm that causes hemoconcentration and affects test results, improper mixing, improper centrifugation, improper storage conditions and transportation, not drawing discard tubes when we're using a butterfly, those kinds of things, and we're short sampling tubes. The only way we can really turn the light on this dark side of phlebotomy is to make sure our staff performs from day one. When we hire them, when they emerge from their training in our facilities, is to make sure they meet certain minimum requirements, that they have proven by observation and by some cognitive assessments that they know the impact of pre-examination errors that they can commit on how the patient's going to be treated. See, we have to connect those dots between the deviations our specimen collection personnel are making while they're performing the procedure and how the patient is going to be treated, medicated, managed, diagnosed, all that. We have to connect the dots for the people who draw the blood. Now, see, it's not enough to say, don't let the patient pump their fist. We got to tell that phlebotomist or the tech or whoever's drawing blood, we have to tell them why. We have to tell them the impact it's going to have on the patient and the patient's care. See, once they know the why, they're not going to do it. But if they just know the what, they might think, well, that's just speculation. We got to prove it to them. We have to show them. We have to connect the dots. There's cause and effect in this pre-analytical phase. And if the cause is an ignorance or a lack of training on the pre-analytical variables that affect patient care, then the effect is going to be poor patient care. So, see, we have to connect the two, cause and effect. So we do this by making sure everybody who draws blood with us and for us is properly trained from day one, and that they're not allowed to go to the dark side, I guess we could say. We could use this metaphor in another way. See, we have our own school of phlebotomy here, and so we're dealing with student issues and clinical site issues all the time. And one of the things that we struggle with, and I know that we're not alone in this, every educator struggles with this. You spend a lot of time and resources and energy creating the best phlebotomist you can create, and they are top-notch when they get out of your orientation program or your training program or your school. They're the best of the best. They've aced the tests, and you just can't wait for them to get out there and start influencing those who work alongside them and raise the level of performance up to their level. And then they get out there, and the opposite happens. Everything you teach them starts to unravel because of peer pressure, because they meet resistance, people don't like being held to a higher standard, see? So it's frustrating for us as a school to send people to clinical sites who then put mentors next to them that poo-poo all of the things that we've taught them that are absolutely critical to not only patient care but their own personal safety when it comes to needle stick prevention and exposure prevention. So what that means for all of us who manage specimen collection personnel is that we've got to make sure that when we put a top performer out in the field or out amongst our staff, that they're immunized against an erosion of their cognitive skills and their technical expertise, the actual ability to successfully perform a venipuncture. So when we immunize them, how do we do that? How do we make sure they're not going to go to the dark side? Well, we make sure that the mentor doesn't live in the dark side, right? We have to make sure that those, if you're in a school or an academic institution and you're sending students out, it doesn't matter if it's phlebotomy or a CLS, we have to make sure that the people that our students are going to be assigned to as mentors really do shine that light on all the variables that affect patient care by way of how they affect test results. So carefully managing the mentors of those we send out into the clinical sites is one way, and establish very good relationships with those that complete the training and the education process that we started as educators. And sometimes, you know, we find when we send our students to our clinical sites, they mean well, they really do. For the most part, when our students are observing or being taught procedures that are different than what we teach them in the classroom, it's not because of people are intentionally malicious or disrespectful. It's just that sometimes they just don't know themselves. So what we do is we try to be educators, and we make ourselves available to our clinical sites to improve the quality of their entire staff. So we will often offer to come in and do free workshops and in-services to the entire staff, even if they're not mentors of our students. They're just the frontline phlebotomists who don't have mentoring responsibilities. They would benefit as well. So see, it's a partnership when you're an educator with a clinical site to make sure that the students we're putting out and that you're putting out don't go to the dark side because they've got a mentor that doesn't have a full appreciation of the effects of deviating from the standards. All right. So if you're a manager and you're not an educator, but you're not an educator at an institution or putting out students to clinical sites, but you're hiring qualified candidates and you're training them in-house, how do you keep them from emerging from your training program and having everything you taught them become unraveled? Well, a lot of the same principles apply. Put them in the hands of mentors who are top-notch, who model the behavior that you want the student to maintain. Make sure they're on the same page with you. And, you know, let's face it, not everybody likes to be mentors to our new hires. And so let's make sure that we don't put people in positions where they can fail because they don't have that interest. Make sure that the folks that are training, your new staff, your new personnel, actually enjoy it. They like teaching, and they like upholding high standards. That's how you're going to perpetuate excellence every time you put a new hire out in your workforce, by putting them with people who have that high, the top performers who have those high standards. So making sure you're not putting people in the hands of mentors who don't care is critical as a manager or a trainer. The other way to keep new hires who are top performers from going to the dark side is to constantly monitor their competence. So I always advocate that we evaluate new hires 3 to 6 months after they've been cleared to draw blood from patients unsupervised in the first place, and annually thereafter. And I really do strongly advocate the competency assessment go way beyond just observing a routine venipuncture, because there's a whole lot you'll never know about a person just by observing a routine puncture. Let's take some time and ask some probing questions that would reveal lapses in their cognitive skills, what they remember from their training and what they might have forgotten. So we need to ask them, what impact does drawing blood in the wrong order have on test results? What do you do when a patient expresses shooting or electric-like pain in their arm? See, all these things they were taught initially, but did they forget? You're not going to know that if all your competency assessment is the observation of a routine venipuncture. That's what we do when we train people at our Train the Trainer workshops, managers like you folks and mentors and educators, how to make sure that phlebotomists don't go to the dark side. And it's not easy, but I tell you what, the dividends pay off enormously. When you take that time and you take those steps to do what's necessary to keep phlebotomists from eroding their skills and their abilities and their cognitive understanding of the effect of the pre-analytical process on laboratory test results. So sample quality is absolutely dependent upon proactive measures like education and training, not just up front, but ongoing. And let's face it, every competency assessment is an educational exercise, isn't it? It should be. And so a competency assessment, to me, my way of thinking is continuing education, because that's where we tell people, okay, yep, you did this right, but here this part needs some work. Let's not forget about the importance of this, and that's when you have the opportunity to remind them of the effects of falling away from the standard on patient care. And not only that, but let's make sure we're providing them with continuing education in the form of, well, hey, podcasts from ASCP, huh? Why not? I mean, come on. I mean, the information is out there. It's not that hard to find. A lot of free stuff out there available. And let's put this kind of material in front of our staff as well, because it will reinforce what you want your staff to remember, what they have been trained in the first place. And reinforcement is so important to keep shining the light on this dark side of phlebotomy. You can't do it without good quality continuing education. So make sure you're providing some exposure to good high quality materials. And it doesn't have to cost a lot. Like I say, a lot of stuff out there is free. So make sure that we seek that stuff out. Assuring sample quality really can't be accomplished without good continuing education. And here's the last part, is a will on your part to discipline infractions. See, because you know as well as I do, some people like to test authority. And we may tell them this is how things have to be done, and this is the way our procedure is written. I expect you to abide by it. But when they test us, we have to make sure that they bump into a wall, that there are boundaries that we put in place to prevent the procedure from being customized, let's say. And there's a lot of people trying to customize the procedure. So, okay, people need boundaries. And we do that by providing effective discipline, coaching. People need consequences for bad behavior, right? And so we can't simply turn our head the other direction, pretend we didn't see it. Not if we want to maintain quality samples in our laboratory and then provide the quality care that is based off of those samples. We can't turn our head to those who test us and those who want to know what our limits are and then don't find them. So we have to make sure people are aware. Hey, these people mean. When they say follow the protocol, my employer means it, and because I have evidence. And I think that needs to be part of any continuing education process as well. So we need to make sure that we've got those elements in place. We're disciplining, we're educating as we go. We're making sure we're putting people in the hands of good quality mentors and that we set them up for success instead of setting them up for failure. And I think, and I firmly believe that once we put these elements in place, and yes, it does take effort. We spend 3 days talking about it at our seminars. But when you put these things in effect, you will see in a relatively short period of time that you will have fewer rejected samples. You will have a happier staff because they have boundaries, right? And they know the path that they're supposed to be on. You're going to have less hemolysis. You're going to have less underfills. You're going to have fewer customer complaints, fewer patient complaints. You're going to have fewer customer service issues that come up. You're going to have, and this is what I really think is the major benefit, you're going to have a stable staff. See, because the phlebotomy staff historically is the staff that has the highest turnover rates. The surveys that Laboratory Medicine publishes on salary surveys and vacancy rates, you take a look at that and you see phlebotomy is really the area where most people turn over. But you know what? When people love their job and they have boundaries and they know they have your support and you're on their side, and you want them to succeed, and they know you want them to succeed, then guess what? They have ownership in the procedure. They have ownership in the laboratory, and they know they're being invested in. And people who know they're being invested in, they stay there because there's not a lot of places out there that invest in their staff. You probably have worked at places that didn't invest in its people. It's not fun. So if you can provide that investment and make sure people know that you're investing in them, you're going to have a stable staff. You're going to have fewer phlebotomists moving on to other positions. Your time is not going to be spent recruiting new phlebotomists to replace the ones who were never happy in the first place because you didn't have everything in place. Okay, so the whole thing is just a beautiful arrangement of strategies that work, and the outcome, it has a great release to it for you as a manager or an educator because your time is freed up. You're not going around putting out fires. And that's the beauty of having a cohesive, unified team of phlebotomists. When they're performing at that high level that you have inspired because of your leadership, then you get to do things that you could not otherwise get to. You're not spending your days putting out fires. You're not answering phone calls from patients who are upset or physicians who are angry because of the way somebody treated the patient or a nurse. You don't have to be a fireman. If you put these elements in place, that builds a cohesive team that always has the light shining on them instead of living in the dark side of phlebotomy. That's my challenge to you. I know it's possible. We see it happening. If people take the time and they have a strategy to get their team of phlebotomists to perform on a higher level, amazing things can happen, and I know it's possible, and I want to give you some hope that it can be done too. It's doable. It really is, and I've immersed myself in this entire pre-examination phase for most of my professional life, and I know that excellence and high performance, quality samples, a cohesive pre-examination team of collectors, I know all these things are possible. It's just that most people don't know how to do it. And hopefully I've been able to give you some kind of a backbone anyways of basic strategies that you can start thinking about implementing. So let me summarize that and we'll wrap it up here. To keep the light shining in this pre-examination phase so that you're not always living or working in the dark side of phlebotomy. Let's make sure that those who are drawing blood for us are properly trained to begin with. Let's make sure that we are putting them in the capable hands of caring, compassionate, and top-performing mentors who don't undo what we've done in the training process. Let's make sure that we're providing continuing education for them in a high-quality type of exercises. Let's make sure that we're evaluating them on a regular basis and using those evaluations as a continuing education tool as well to keep people on the straight and narrow. And let's discipline infractions when coaching the nice way just doesn't work. Some people just flat out need consequences, and let's provide those in a caring, compassionate, coaching kind of way. And then we can just stand back and prepare to be amazed. Thank you.